1620. Welcome to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. Hope you are having a great Saturday. Hope we can make that Saturday even just a little bit better by bringing you up to date on everything that's going on in entertainment and pop culture. And joining me to do so, as he does so very often on this show, please welcome from the Pop Culture Knowledge channel on YouTube, Jeremy Branch.
Thanks for having me. This is the first Saturday of daylight savings time, which means we're getting longer days, we're getting into warmer weather, and I'm here for it. I'm a big proponent of the being light later, but I know there's like a huge conversation about daylight savings and the way that it affects people's sleep schedule and all of that. Real quick, what do you think? Are you for or against this daylight savings thing?
I think that if we're gonna change it, we got to change it nationwide. I think this notion that we're going to change it in Florida, which has been kind of passed, but you can't really change it unless it gets approved from Congress to change it for some reason. I think it's just asking for trouble. We already have enough trouble with having two time zones in the state.
Yeah,
if we have to where we're not only in Pensacola, we're not only off kilter with the Eastern time zone, we're going to be off kilter with the you know, we're what, 10 minutes from Alabama, and it's going to be a different time there too. I think that's just causing too much trouble. I don't have a problem
running and jump to the other time zone if that were the case.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with doing away with daylight savings time or doing away with standard time and staying on daylight time all year long, which is what Florida wants to do.
But it's
got to be nationwide. It's just asking for too much trouble to do it anything else.
Otherwise, I agree with you. Just
leave it like it is. It's not that big a deal. Yes, it does kind of be rough to adjust to for, you know, a week or so, but then you get over it and you're fine. And I'm pretty close to being already over it. I am here for the longer sunlight. I am here for the warmer weather for sure, because I do not have it in me for the cold anymore.
Mm-mm.
I am not down with the cold anymore. I'm looking forward to the warmer weather and not having to, you know, make sure I have a jacket every time I leave the house.
You hit me up on Tuesday. I hate to switch gears so suddenly, but I didn't really want to talk about daylight savings time. I thought we just had an obligation to for the folks at home. But what I really want to talk to you about is what you hit me up about on Tuesday via text. You found out some news.
Oh, we doing the Scream thing.
Yeah, let's talk about Scream real quick. We got a minute.
I forgot that we were going to talk about that. Yeah. So big news, kind of when, you know, Jeremy and I have talked a lot about the Scream franchise and the future of the Scream franchise after they unceremoniously fired Melissa Barrera and then Jenna Ortega said, oh yeah, well, I'm out too. And they tried to say that it's not because they fired Melissa Barrera, but come on, we all know better. It's filming schedule on Wednesday. That's delaying a film that they don't even have a script for yet. Yep, I believe you. Sure, that's all it was. It wasn't, you know, that you fired, you know, her fellow actor that plays her sister. Not that at all. I believe you, Spyglass Entertainment. You are telling us the absolute unvarnished truth.
This is something that you mentioned since the beginning. And as we get to see a bigger picture about all that's been happening behind the scenes at Spyglass, it's pretty obvious to me that this didn't really have anything to do with Wednesday.
Yeah. So now that being said, one of the things that we saw as a possible for them to fix what they've done to this franchise is, I said in so many words, get a big truck full of money, back it up to the Campbell residence, and empty it out into Neve Campbell's house.
And do you think that would work?
Well, I mean, that's what they're doing.
Seems like it.
Yeah, that it was announced this week that Neve Campbell, after sitting out Scream 6, will be returning to the franchise in Scream 7. Cool. Good move. I think it was a mistake to cut her out of the franchise, although I thought Scream 6 was a very good movie and enjoyed it very much. And I bought what they did with the character in that and the way they wrote her out. So now they've got an interesting decision to come to, though, and that is, how do they fix this? Because they've now made it to where these two characters, played by Melissa Barrera and Jenna Ortega, are maybe just as integral to the franchise as Neve Campbell's character, Sydney, is.
I mean, especially at this particular moment in the franchise, but you actually proposed something that I kind of like, and I don't know how much time we have, but if you just want to like pitch your cool idea, that would be a pretty good place to start.
Yeah, I think that they've got to find a way to bring Melissa and Jenna back in. I think that if you try to do something like kill them off screen, the fans are going to riot, and I'll be right there with them.
I feel like that's probably the, in the situation that we're in, probably the only viable option.
I disagree. I think there are a number of ways that they could go forward, one of which is that they could just back up trucks of money to their houses, too, and bring them back in.
You know, yeah, assuming that Barrera's not standing on principle, just like, screw you guys, but I guess with enough money, are principles?
I don't think it's that. I think it's that Spyglass has to come out and say, hey, we overreacted, we were wrong, we want you back. And they have to publicly say that.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that's what it would take, because I do think it would take more than money. I do think Melissa Barrera is a principled person, and I think that's where this all started. So it's going to take Spyglass to come out and say, we overreacted, we want you back, and here's a truckload of money.
You know? Yeah, but if this doesn't work, you had another interesting idea.
I think that they can buy some time here. I think that the way that you buy some time here is you have Scream 7 take place parallel to Scream 6. In other words, this movie is taking place at the same time that Scream 6 is taking place.
It
is following what's going on with Sydney while the events of Scream 6 are happening. I think there has not been one Ghostface that has been in every movie. So it would be, in fact, we had technically 4 ghost faces in this movie, in Scream 6?
Yeah, lots of ghost faces. Five.
So it is entirely possible to have a different ghost face over in, what's the name of the town again? I always forget the name of the town.
Woodsboro.
Or wherever Sydney locked herself away.
Space!
Yeah. Well, we're not into Jason X territory yet. Let's hope we don't get there. Although that would be kind of interesting. So have that take on, tell a story that is taking place parallel to Scream 6. So doesn't involve any of the characters that are in Scream 6. So it gives you an excuse to not have Melissa and Jenna there and to be able to stay from their story without stepping away from the overall storyline. That means also no Courtney Cox. That means no Hayden Panettiere or, you know, any of the other characters that were in that. But there's lots of other characters in the Scream franchise that could theoretically come back. You know, maybe
one
even
in particular.
Well, what are you thinking?
I mean, come on. If we're bringing back Neve Campbell, this is the time, right? We give the fans what they want, and Stu comes back as Ghostface, and he's like got a personal vendetta against Sydney, and I think that would be a way to really win the fans back over, and like you said, and I think very importantly, buy some time.
I mean, people would love to see Matthew Lillard back. I'm not sure that I want to get into resurrecting people from the dead in this franchise. I like the fact that this franchise is fairly grounded, so there's got to be a real good explanation for how Stu's not dead.
I agree.
Same token, another thing they could do is they could find a way that Dewey is still alive and find a way to bring David Arquette back too.
But he got stabbed a bunch. Stu just got a TV dropped on his head.
Oh, just a TV. That's all. You know, just a
and
TV.
Stabbed. Yeah. And,
how many times have you gotten over a TV being dropped on your head? All right, we got to take a break. We'll be back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.
blue and you don't know where to go to. Why don't you go where fashion sits, putting on the Ritz. Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes and cutaway coat, perfect fits, putting on the Ritz. Dressed up like a $1 million trooper, trying hard to look like Gary Cooper. Come, let's mix where Rockefellers walk with sticks or umbrellas in the midst, putting on the Ritz.
News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I'm your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line from the Pop Culture Nihilist channel on YouTube. And Jeremy, of course, Hollywood put on the Ritz last weekend as we got into the Academy Awards, the Oscars, the 9,473,000th Academy Awards. Is that right?
Correct. Nailed it.
Somewhere along there, a lot of awards. Bunch of people got dressed up, gave each other awards. It was a whole thing, you know. So I don't know how much of the ceremony you got to see. I got to see most of it. I am a big fan of the Oscars in general. I was a little busy Sunday night, but I did come in right as they were presenting the first award to, no surprise whatsoever, Davon Joy Randolph for the Holdovers, who won every supporting actress award throughout the season. So, and that was the first award of the night. So I saw that through to the very end. You know, I thought it was a good show overall. I think for a lot of people, the highlight was probably the performance of I'm Just Ken by Ryan Gosling, which did
so
not.
While we were on break, you told me that that's something that I needed to check out. So I put it on YouTube and I watched it, and I could easily see it being one of the highlights of the night.
Yeah, I mean, they made a huge production out of it, kind of like something out of an old school Hollywood musical. The big dance number with all of the Kens from the movie were there with him. So Simu Liu was there, and Shuri Gatwa, and Kingsley Benadir, and the other guy, I forget who the last Ken is. There were four Kens besides Ryan Gosling's Ken. And all of them are well known for other things except for the last guy whose name I can't remember. I'm sure he is too, but anyway, so they were all there.
But we can't. Two cinephiles can't think of who he is. So yeah. I'm sure he's really well known outside of us.
I would honestly have to look it up. he may, and it may be one of those things where when I look it up, I'm going to be like, oh, it was that dude. But you know, whatever. So all the Kens were there. You know, they had this great big production number. They're dancing in the crowds, and Ryan Gosling's getting out there and dancing with Margot Robbie and Greta Gerwig, and then does a little La La Land callback and dances with Emma Stone. And apparently, according to her, managed to break her dress, because she talked about that when she got up to accept her award. We'll talk about that in a minute. And Slash shows up to play the guitar solo. Wolfie Van Halen was out there too.
Awesome.
It was a great moment. There were a number of really good moments. I thought overall the show was very good. I think Kimmel continues to be a good host. He can take command of the festivities when he needs to, and he can get out of the way when he doesn't. I think definitely the other big bit I think a lot of people will remember is Kimmel giving a call back to 50 years ago when there was a streaker that ran across the stage at the Oscars infamously in 74. This was not something that was planned or anything. This was somebody that rushed the stage, and streaking was a trend in the 70s.
For political reasons, nothing about being an exhibitionist.
Nah, I think it depends. I don't think in this particular case, yeah. You know. Anyway, at any rate, you know, it's set up that, you know, Kimmel had convinced somebody else to streak, and turns out that the person he had convinced to streak didn't want to do it anymore. And that person was none other than John Cena, and who then had to give out the next award naked. And the award, of course, being for best costumes.
It was so weird. Like, somebody had to tell me, because all I saw was like a floating ballot coming out onto the stage. Sorry, obligatory you can't see me joke.
Yeah, no, it's all good.
We'll move on.
Yeah, no, but yeah, it was really funny, and yeah, it was a good moment. It was a moment a lot of people talk about.
Yep.
Obviously, we know John Cena didn't actually come out on stage completely nude, but dude had to be pretty close.
They like released, and this is wild. You never get special features on the Oscars. There was like eight publications covering the process that Jimmy Kimmel and John Cena went through to get this through the, I guess, the ratings board or the censors or whatever, and then how they put a prosthetic, like Ken doll's bodysuit around his nether regions. And it was just really funny to see the culture so fascinated in how they had him do it. I kind of just took it at face value, and I thought it was hilarious. John Cena's just up for anything. I saw him in Ricky Stenicki a couple days ago, and the movie sucks. But John Cena's very funny in it.
I really think, yeah, we're kind of going off on a little bit of a tangent here, but I think that if you were to rank, and maybe this is something we should do on the show sometime, to rank the all-time wrestlers turned actors, I think you got to have Cena in the top three.
I think you and I are probably pretty unanimous on who they are. The order, though, might be a little bit different. But back to the Academy Awards, man. Early on in the goings, I thought Poor Things may really end up sweeping the awards. And I know you and I had actually broken down our predictions. If you're listening to this and you didn't have an opportunity to do that and you want to see how our predictions lined up with what actually happened, go back and check out last episode. You'll hear those there. But it became abundantly clear that Oppenheimer was indeed, to your point, this was the year of Oppenheimer. Other than a couple of small things, I didn't think there were any major surprises, Julio. Any like stand up highs, lows, awards you would have done differently, any of that?
I wasn't hugely surprised at the way a lot of the awards went. I think probably the biggest question mark going into the night was probably Lily Gladstone or Emma Stone for Best Actress. Of course,
this actually blows my mind that this happened.
I kind of thought that was the way it was going to go. I really did. And honestly, if I'm just going to be completely honest here, if it was me voting, I would have voted for Emma Stone.
Yeah,
I just think it's a better performance and it's more central to the movie. And I think that's to the detriment of Killers of the Flower Moon. I think Killers of the Flower Moon should have been told from her perspective. And instead it was told from the white guy's perspective. And that's kind of the biggest problem with the movie. You know, for this movie to be the subject matter that it is, and it's from the perspective of a white guy who's kind of a villain, I think was kind of a misstep. I think Lily Gladstone is fantastic. I think she's going to have more bites at the apple. But I think that Emma Stone was the better performance. I think that they went the right way on this award.
I'm going to go a different direction because I definitely think what you're saying has merit. A different movie from a different perspective would be equally or even maybe more impactful. I think the choice was made to make it from the kind of villain's perspective in Killers of the Flower Moon. And I wouldn't say it was a detriment to the film. I just think in a different movie, Lily Gladstone's performance would have been more pivotal and as you said, more central to the story.
Yeah, but other than that, I can't think of a whole lot of big surprises. I would have given animated feature to Across the Spider-Verse instead of The Boy and the Heron. I just did not
That's
really...
That's the one I was going to bring up. Yeah. I feel like that was probably the only upset to me. As you said, it kind of went as expected, but I agree. I would have given it to Across the Spider-Verse as well.
It didn't really surprise me because Miyazaki is such a master of animation, and this is said to be his farewell film.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not surprised, even though he has won one before. You know, you're talking about one of the legends of animation. I get it. The film did not really resonate with me the way some of his other work has. And
yep.
I just thought Across the Spider-Verse was a better film all around. That's okay. There's going to be another Spider-Verse film. There'll be another opportunity. And of course, the first Spider-Verse film did win. So it's not like these filmmakers haven't been honored either. That's the only one where I was just like, yeah, I'd have gone a different way on this. But overall, I was pretty pleased. You know, my top four movies of the year all won awards. Of course, Oppenheimer won 7. Very happy with that. Poor Things won 4. Very happy with that. And then we got a great Best Adapted Screenplay Award for American Fiction by Ford Jefferson winning for that and giving a great speech when he won. And then Best Special Effects went to Godzilla Minus One.
Let's go.
That was so cool to see those filmmakers get up the because the director of the film also led the special effects team on the film. So the director of the film did win an Oscar for the film and kind of led the discussion. They all got up with matching Godzilla shoes on and holding matching gold Godzilla statues. And it was just so cool to see that. That was the one of the night where I literally like just shouted out loud when they won. I was
30 animators and about $15 million. And you can create just one of the most impressive looking movies of the year.
Well, and you know, think about that compared to Hollywood budgets and what they did.
Yeah.
And they won.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there were, don't get me wrong, there the other competitors in the category were definitely deserving as well. But man, I was so excited to see that award go the way that it went. Beyond that, you know, I don't think there were a whole lot of surprises in the night. Robert Downey Jr., great speech, but again, very expected.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a little bit of a question mark over whether it would be Cillian Murphy or Paul Giamatti for Best Actor, but it went to me, no surprise, to Cillian Murphy. And then, you know, again, Best Supporting Actress, not really a surprise. Director, not really a surprise. Unsurprised also that after all the hype, Barbie only won one award, and it was for Best Original Song. Interesting to note, Billie Eilish, now the youngest person ever to win 2 competitive Oscars.
Oh, yeah, that's impressive. I was talking to Victoria about the fact that this girl has just been a top-tier music star since she was about 17 years old. I think she's just now 21 or something like that. And it's just wild to think that she's as accomplished as she is at that age.
Well, think about it, too. She has 2 Oscars. If you want to go in apples to apples here, Danny Elfman, none.
Well, I mean, what has Danny Elfman ever done that was iconic?
Yeah. To say nothing of people like, you know, Alfred Hitchcock or anything like that. But anyway, we got to take a break. We'll be back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.
Walked into your venom was lethal. I almost believed you. Yeah, you prayed on my every mistake, waited on me to pray. Held me under, hoping I would drown like a plague. I was racing away, trying to find my way out, find my way out. And then finally came the day I stopped giving my heart away. For heaven's sake, my bones will break. But you never own my soul. No, I feel you crumble in my arms down to your heart of stone. You bled me dry just like the tears you never show. Why don't you tell me what you want for me? Tell me what you need for me? Tell me what you want to go. Why don't you tell me what you want for me? Tell me what you need for me? Tell me what you want to go.
News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line from the Pop Culture Knowledge Channel on YouTube. And you may or may not be familiar with that song called Take What You Want. That's by Post Malone featuring Ozzy Osbourne and Travis Scott. The song's a few years old, came out in 2019, but you may have heard it recently in the trailer for the upcoming movie The Crow. Not Rufio. No, that.
Excuse me.
Although I'm here for the Rufio movie. If they want to make the Rufio movie, I'll go see that movie. But yeah, there's a trailer for the new movie, The Crow, that just dropped this week. We've been talking about this movie for a while. This is, of course, a remake of the 1994 film that starred Brandon Lee. And maybe you can call it a remake, or maybe you call it a new adaptation of the original comic by J.O. Barr. I don't know. You can look at that as you want. But we do have in this movie, returning to the story of Eric Draven, which was the story of the first movie. The other sequels to The Crow that have come out since 1994 were based on different characters. And then there was a series in the early 2000s that was based on the Eric Draven character again. And now we're getting back to that character, basically telling at least a similar to, if not the same story from the original film. And we've got this trailer out, and the internet is just aflame with commentary on this trailer. Everybody has got their take on this trailer. Seems like most of those takes are pretty negative. And I got to say, Jeremy, having watched the trailer before the show, I don't understand why everybody's so up in arms about this. It seems like a perfectly fine Evanescence music video to me.
Yeah. I think that's a fair take, Julio.
I mean, that's what the trailer looks like to me. It's kind of like, you know, like a semi-edgy, like early 2000s music video. Like, well, I mean, more than semi-edgy, because this is an R-rated movie, and it's definitely got a lot of violence in it. It wouldn't have played on MTV just like it is. Let's put it that way. It would have been censored. But yeah, I mean, it looks kind of dated, but I don't necessarily think that's the wrong way to go either, because The Crow in and of itself is kind of tied to the 90s. So,
yeah, but that doesn't mean make an early 2000s action movie.
Well, and it does look a lot like that, but it does look a lot like that through the lens of like a John Wick.
Absolutely. Yeah, now we're getting to the freaking core of it. It looks like a John Wick trailer. And hey, look, if you've listened to this show any amount, you know, both Julio and myself really like John Wick. It's a great franchise. I just didn't. And a lot of people, you know, rightfully point out Brandon Lee is a martial artist. Certainly, he could have done some martial arts in The Crow, but I didn't think the action and especially graphic violence were like essential to the story. It just feels wrong to me. So obviously, I'm on the side of I'm not a fan. Yeah. I don't particularly dislike the song that we get in the trailer, but I certainly don't like it either. You know, when Julio and I were first talking at the beginning of the show, we were discussing ways that we could potentially approach the Scream 7 movie. And if I were in charge creatively, I would have at least put the Cure song Burn in the trailer to evoke that feeling of the first one. If everything were the same and they put Burn in the trailer, I think it would have increased the goodwill. But more specifically, and to something you just said, Julio, this did not have to be Eric Draven. They could do a million Crow movies, and the majority of them would suck. As you said, there were four Crow movies that came out within a decade. Only one of them were any good, but we can just ignore the other ones because they didn't really make an impression on anybody, but here we are like decades later and there's all these big names attached to it and they've been working on it for an eternity. So I would have thought they could have come up with something that would have been the least bit clever, and this seems the opposite of clever.
Well, I mean, I get what you're saying about using Burn, and Burn is such a classic song and it is so associated with the original movie, but I wonder if that wouldn't have been a double-edged sword too. People are already negatively comparing this movie to the original, despite the fact that nobody's seen
You're right.
the movie. So if you make the comparison that much more overt, if you give people even more to gauge it against, are you handing them the weapon that they're going to kill you with? You know what I mean?
I know 100%. I think that's a great point. And I do think it's kind of a calculated risk. However, by using the name Eric Draven, we're not separating ourselves enough to not be still sitting on that razor's edge. I feel like one interesting choice would have been to make it a period piece. Let's go back to the 1980s. Okay, that's been done to death. Let's go back to the 1990s. But what I think would be really cool, to my point that they could make 1,000 different Crow movies, what if it was a Western? What if it was almost like a spaghetti Western? Instead of the man with no name, we get another Crow character, and the Skull Daddy or whatever that character's name was, is Skull Cowboy? Yeah. Is like a integral part of it. And instead of doing the industrial music, we do like the what's his name score, like from Hang 'Em High and Fistful of Dollars and all that.
Sergio Leone, not Sergio Leone. Angelo Badalamenti.
No, it's Mancioni or something.
Oh,
like
yeah,
that.
Oh yeah, Ennio Morricone. Sorry.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
I mean, that could be interesting. There's definitely a lot of ways you could go with this property, but I think at the same time, the excitement behind this was the idea of going back to the Eric Draven story. And I think that's partly why none of the other ones really succeeded, aside from the fact that they just weren't very good movies, that people fell in love with Eric Draven. And I don't even think that it's really that people fell in love with Eric Draven. I think they fell in love with Brandon Lee. And I think that they fell in love with the romantic notion of Brandon Lee having died during the making of this movie.
There's so empathetic in his, it's weird that he is so much better than the movie, and by all rights, a pretty inexperienced actor. He hadn't done a lot of work, but there's something so soulful and mournful about that performance in that movie that I feel like very few people could make it work. I like Bill Skarsgård, and I don't even dislike the way he looks in this movie. Those are big shoes to fill. And as you said, with everything that surrounded The Crow, it's impossible to recapture that.
Yeah, and that's the thing here, is people get on this, I've said this before, people get on this, the hill that they're going to die on is that The Crow is this inviolable classic that nobody should ever touch. And guys, I love the movie, but it's not an inviolable classic. It's not like this is, you know, one of the paragons of cinema. It's a really good film from the 90s. It's not even
atmospheric.
I would go so far as to say it's probably not even one of the 10 best films of 1994.
You're insane. 1994, there were a bunch of good movies that came out that year.
1994 is a great year for cinema. It's one of the greatest years in the history of cinema. You had films like Pulp Fiction, Shawshank Redemption, Forrest Gump, Quiz Show.
Desperado?
Desperado, Clerks. You know, I mean, it's
Tombstone, maybe?
Yeah. Oh, God, Tombstone's such a great movie.
So good.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of great films that came out in 94. The Crow is among them, don't get me wrong. But is it a top 10 of 94? That's a very competitive year to be saying what's in the top 10 for.
Well, so. And, you know, you jokingly mentioned the Evanescence music video aesthetic of the new trailer. You know, the original Crow is very much got a industrial 90s music video aesthetic to it. But for me, it was that world. It was this rain-soaked, burning, apocalyptic view of Detroit and the costume design and the score and all of these ingredients that on any of their own maybe wouldn't add up to the sum of its parts. And then you take all of the real-world stuff and you add that into the metadata, and The Crow is just... we'll take classic and skill out of it and just say it is such a touchstone of a moment in time.
Agreed.
That it can't be remade.
Agreed. And let's be honest, the Evanescence music video, that's where they get the inspiration for it, is from this movie.
Yeah, that's a fact.
Yeah, we got to take a break. We'll be back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.
Get your teeth.
1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line from the Pop Culture Analyst channel on YouTube. And if you walk without rhythm, you won't attract the worm. That's right.
I was wondering what the correlation there was. That's good.
You know, I listened to that song, of course, Weapon of Choice by Fatboy Slim, for years and years and years before I realized that the lyrics are based on Dune.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
Yeah, but yeah, they are, and that's why I played that, because we were going to talk about Dune Part 2, which is in theaters right now. It's been out for a couple of weeks now, so hopefully everybody's had a chance to see it, so we may get into a little bit of spoilery discussion of the film and how it relates to the overall Dune franchise. And, yeah, let's just say this first of all, Jeremy, independently of whatever else I might think of the film itself, let's dictate up front that visually this film is a masterpiece. As was
I don't
the
like
one.
Where this is going.
Well, I mean, I'm not
just
saying
the whole vibe, the whole way you're starting this thing off. I can tell already. I don't like your thoughts on this movie.
Well, no, I mean, I think that this film and the first one are both visual masterpieces. My biggest issue with the films is I think that we've had two films and something like 5 to 6 hours worth of material here so far. And I still don't feel like we've told a complete story.
Let me, real quick, and we won't get bogged down in this because I'm sure we have a lot to discuss. What's different between this and Across the Spider-Verse to you?
The first one told a complete story. I will agree that the second Spider-Verse movie did not, and it was clear going in that it was not going to. But the first one I did feel like told a complete story. Like if they had not made another story after that, if the movie had not been a hit, it still would have been a satisfying movie on its own.
Yeah, you're right. I agree with that 100%. I think I was looking at it a little more on the micro regarding this particular entry, but you're right. If they never made a sequel to the first Dune, it would not have been a full and satisfying story.
And I feel like we're still not at a, like both of these movies just kind of end. Like
moving past that, do you feel like knowing that Spider-Man 2 was a part 2 of 3 changes it versus did you know when you were going to see Dune that it wasn't the end of the story?
I knew that the first movie was only intended to be an adaptation of the first half of the book.
Okay.
And I think that, I actually think the first one ended a little more climactically than the second one did.
Okay.
So I think the first one actually achieved a little more of being a complete story than the second one did.
Interesting.
But that being said, it's not that I don't care for the film. I actually thought it was very good, and it's been kind of in my head to see it again. I kind of wish I had seen it in IMAX, and I'm hoping I still get a chance to do that.
Yeah.
But again, visually, it's fantastic. Villeneuve is by far one of the most visionary artists from a visual standpoint that we have working in film right now. The cast is top notch. They're, you know, just some of the best actors working in Hollywood right now. A friend of mine said something to the extent of, the Dune franchise has tied up all the most beautiful people in Hollywood right now. To which I responded, almost.
Including?
If they just add Alexandria Daddario and Haley Steinfeld, then I will feel like, yeah, they've co-opted just about everybody.
Yeah. I mean, it is a very beautiful cast. They were all featured on Jimmy Kimmel Live a couple of weeks ago, and just like, wow, these people are like otherworldly hot. But
oh yeah, just a bunch of beautiful men and women in this movie, by far.
I thought that Dune 2 was the end of the series, and then it was about 20 minutes before the end of the movie that I was like, oh, there's no way that everything's getting wrapped up here. So I was a little bit surprised by the way that it ended. I echo everything you said. Visually, just incredible. But I also think like the sound design and the performances and the atmosphere and the world building, like when they go to that, I'm not going to be able to think of the characters and they are the race of characters right now, but when they go to the black and white world and
the Harkonnen's home world. Yeah.
Yes. What a cool freaking aesthetic. The costume, like everything about it, we can go on about all the kind of like movie review jargon, all that stuff is there. What I find the most interesting about this story is the way that it uses a very far off otherworldly setting to explore just really, really human themes. And like, it's messy. Like you're kind of led along this certain path, believing that what you're seeing is a conventional story, and then it just continuously pulls the rug out from under you and changes the where your empathy lies and your understanding of who these characters are and what kind of motivations drive them. And I absolutely love that. The reason why I liked this one so much is because it recontextualizes the way that you see the main most important character of the movie. And I think that's super risky and was pulled off really well.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with that. And in fairness, you know, I did know going into this that Villeneuve was already out there saying, I want to make the third chapter.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, so it's not like I was totally surprised that there was more story to tell. Because first of all, there are about 947 million Dune novels.
Yeah, you know, I heard.
Frank Herbert's son kept writing them after Frank Herbert passed. So, you know, there is a lot of material out there to potentially mine if you so desire. However, it was not originally conceived that way. Dune was originally conceived as, originally published as a series of stories, like not even like a novel, like it was a series of stories in magazines. And then they were consolidated and rewritten into a novel. And mm-hmm. then a sequel came, and then more sequels came, and more and more and more. So we've gotten through in an adapted format that has changed some things, the story of the first novel in the course of these first two movies.
Do you know broad strokes where this all ends?
No, I don't, honestly.
Because me neither.
I haven't read every single novel, but I know that there were significant changes. I know that there's a time jump in the novel that did not take place in the movie. I know that the character that we see in the one scene played by Anya Taylor-Joy is meant to be a future flash forward to Paul's sister, who his mother is pregnant with in the course of the movie, that we may see in the future. That's being played out differently than it did in the book and also than in previous movie adaptations. So, you know, there's been, and that's been a criticism that some people have lobbed toward this movie, is the changes from the source material. I have not read the source material, so I am not lavishly tied to that.
Same.
I like the film. I do want to see it again and see if I have a little bit greater appreciation for it the second time through.
I'll go with you. Let's go.
Yeah.
You tell me when. We'll be there.
All right. Fair enough. But I, like I said, visually, it's a masterpiece. Overall storytelling, I'm not sure that it's a masterpiece or not. I kind of felt the same way about Villeneuve's Blade Runner sequel, too, to be completely honest.
Ooh, my, like, dude, two of my favorite movies that you're talking about. I mean, and I get it, though.
And I'm a Blade Runner fan. And I think that, again, that's a beautiful film, but I don't know that it hit all the marks it needed to hit. That being said, like, Arrival, that's a masterpiece from start to finish. And that's also Villeneuve.
Do you find his sci-fi epics to be too ponderous?
No, I don't
think. And
I do think there are places where this movie in particular is a little slow. But no, overall, I don't. I think he's a great filmmaker. I think that he is somebody that we are going to continue to see as a great filmmaker for a long time to come. I don't think he's hit his peak yet.
That's exciting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. It is. It's interesting, though, because as much as I think that he hasn't reached his peak yet, he's going to have, assuming he gets to make Dune 3, which I think looks like it's going to happen, he's going to have spent a good chunk of his life on making these Dune movies. And that's great and all, but I do kind of want to see what other stories he's got in him.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And a lot of it has been dedicated to other people's source material.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens. But, you know, I definitely looking forward to seeing what else Denis Villeneuve brings us over the years. And I'm looking forward to seeing what we talk to you about next week. We are done for this week, but we will see you back here next week. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.